Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Hi Bob, the officially unofficial For All Mankind podcast on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking the season finale for season 3. It's episode 10, Stranger in a Strange Land. Aaron, how did this season finale stack up against the other two season finales we've seen?
I thought it was really good. I was the first one to bring up the potential shark jump of last week. And if this is what shark jumping looks like, I guess I'm into jumping sharks. Call me a shark lord. I'm into it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought that the cold open of this Korean astronaut's battle to make it down to the surface, bury his partner, survive for, 5 to 6 months. I thought it was a gripping. There's a lot of like comedy that kind of like lightened a little bit of the load. And also like, I'm starting to see this show work the way like I've talked about Star Trek The Next Generation working, or like The Expanse works, where they've got the dynamics between people so good that when a scene starts with like any two particular people, especially like when Molly's sending a recording to Ed, you just get a smile on your face because you know it's going to be an awesome scene because of what they bring to the table. Just like anytime you saw, you know, Riker and Data start to have a wry conversation about Data's sex life or whatever, it's just like you get, you know, or Amos and Bobby start squaring up, it's like you just get like, oh fuck yeah. And there is tons of those scenes in this episode. So like I noticed like on the Reddit and even our feedback, people are talking about the soapiness of this show, the tawdry romances, the baby mm-hmm. births, all that kind of stuff.
Welcome to Ron Moore's fiction. Yeah,
it is soapy, but like I feel like this show, I don't know whether I'm giving a pass because I'm just deep down, I was born in the height of the space race and I was surrounded by rockets growing up. And I think it's cool. And I think NASA's cool. And I think, this, you know, getting out in space is cool. And I'm just making excuses for this show or what. But like, I think some of these more soapy aspects are ways to rapidly get you to care and have opinions on things, because this show just moves so quick. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking 30 years of these people's lives, and we get 6 month snippets every decade or so, and they have to go big. They have to play for the cheap seats because there's not time to do the, you know, like Breaking Bad had 6 years to consider what, 6 months of like, or 7 months of his family's life in the most of the series. They don't have that. So I feel like they're doing this to like rocket fuel, emotional rocket fuel. And it fucking works. Mm-hmm. This Russo guy that is doing their soundtrack, I think he's approaching Max Richter levels of pianomanship, where that shit starts and then they throw a soaring violin into it and I'm just a shambles. I wept so much on the last 30 minutes of this show. Wow, so yeah, okay. I all that stuff, the father-daughter stuff, the the inverse of the Kelly Ed dynamic, all of it I thought was just great. And I was extremely satisfied by almost everything that happened. And I'm back ready. Can't wait to go forward another 8 years in the future for next season. Jim, what'd you think?
I was also a big fan of this finale, and yeah, I see the soap opera elements, whatever. I've settled into Ron Moore storytelling and I enjoy it. Some of my favorite moments in this episode are some of the more understated ones, I'd say. Some of the ones that are like almost secondary to what's actually going on in this episode. Margo's stuff really got me. I like her speech at the end there and Elaida's reaction to it, and just like knowing the finality of it and understanding like who she is as a character. Because she genuinely cares and loves this stuff, right? She's not cynical. She's not anything. She just got caught up in a bad situation. And this speech she gives that's reminiscing about, you know, her early days. And it helped also when I went back, I was looking at the episode screenshots for season two and season one, because I went back and I was thinking, okay, which finales do I like the best? And boy, they have really done so much to change these people's appearances. It's not obviously apparent unless you're comparing them. And when I saw those screenshots, I was like, I started to get a little bit like nostalgic myself for those early seasons, mm-hmm. when these characters are much younger and just coming up in this organization. And it was really impactful for me to hear Margo give this speech that, you know, and especially, you know, with her walking out of the stadium at the end, right? Or whatever, yeah. You know, this is kind of like her farewell speech. One way or another.
Joe Green making his way through the locker room. That scene you talked about, what made it even greater is that Margo and Elaida are the only one that know what it actually means.
Yes.
And like by the end of the speech, it's almost like they're just talking to each other. It's very intimate. They go from a room full of people to just the connection that like these people know this is the end of an era.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be over before you know it.
And yeah, it's pretty powerful. I really like that stuff. And that's one of the other things that Ron Moore does extremely well. You know, he does the soap opera elements, but he does these very emotional speeches very well, mm-hmm. for me. The monologues, that stuff really works.
And also, like, I don't know. Like, I was pretty sure Kelly would make it off the planet and give birth successfully, but like, mm-hmm. it was really touch and go with like, is Ed gonna live?
Yeah, totally.
And I know my son, I was watching this with him for the first time, and he was a basket case because he is an unabashed Ed fan. He's mm-hmm. it's his favorite character. The old man's already looking pretty old, and that looked pretty bad. That fade to black, that looked pretty definitive. And you know, pairing it with the Johnson Space Center disaster. Mm-hmm. And his wife is like, I felt like I do feel like this show could kill anyone at any time because that's the way space travel is. And I didn't think it had it in it to kill Kelly, but I wasn't sure. So like a lot of this stuff works because there isn't like designated safe characters that are going to survive season to season show. And some of them, when you think they're okay, like it was kind of a punch to the gut to find out that Molly died in her Johnson Space Center heroics.
So I was let down by a couple of elements. And these are tied together. I was let down by the
You did
Molly
not
stuff.
Like this, I guess? You didn't like it?
I did not like that they just kind of yada yada Molly's death. And there's no real reason I saw for Molly to die. I thought like the worst of it was over by the time Molly went back in to help find other people. And everybody I saw in JSC was not like choked with smoke inhalation. So I assume she died of smoke inhalation. They don't even say. They're just like,
or the structure could have collapsed on her. Like they she was found buried in rubble.
But we never see any of it, right? Like they don't even tell us how she died. It's just
I only know that because I freeze framed on the newspaper in red. But I'm like, well, she got buried in rubble. But I'm like, wait a second, that's literally only a 0.5 second scene that you have to freeze frame on the newspaper. Yeah. But like, I'm like, well, I mean, to me, like, I figure you're going into a building that's on fire, and you're blind and this is your superpower in this scene, because I think they're trying to tell us that this building is choked with smoke and that an average person couldn't make it their way out. But she's got the superpower of number one, being the unflappable Molly Cobb.
Sure,
and number two, navigating those hallways blind for years gave her like this, you know, almost like fucking Daredevil shit.
Yeah, so, she has a number of steps and all that, yeah.
But it is. It's like who lived and who died was genuinely shocking to me and felt like suitable gut punches. You know, like Molly Cobb dying is the end of an era. And then
I thought, the big moment that Ed dying would have been, right? Because they didn't give it to her in this episode. They just do it off screen. Like, if Ed had died and we saw him crash into the surface of the planet, that's a big moment for him.
But, Karen
imagine
dying.
If, like, they boosted off Kelly and they just never came back to Ed's chip. And then in the newspaper, it said,
you saw the hero astronaut Ed Baldwin dies and
crashes into surface of Mars and dies. You'd be super disappointed, right? So, like, I felt that way about Molly.
Yeah. I guess it felt exactly like what it would be. It was barely front page news on an absolutely bonkers news day.
Yeah.
And like there's almost a sadness and a melancholy of these fucksticks these conspiracy shitheads. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, this is obviously inspired by the Murrow building bombing in Oklahoma City that I fucking lived through. I mean, the entire facade mm-hmm. of JSC, it's almost like a Photoshop job. It looks so much yep. like that. But these assholes have injected all this hatred and malice into what should be a triumphant day of the best of humanity, self-sacrificing so that others may live, going through hardships, communal hardships, so that other people can have a shot at a better life. Mm-hmm. And these guys, under the guise of getting justice for Gordo and Tracy, are murdering all these people, blowing up this building. I mean, the thing is, I guess I like it also because I don't know if you noticed this, but the headline makes it clear that the JSC, the Johnson Space Center, is now the Molly Cobb Space Center.
Yeah, I saw that.
So I thought that's kind of cool that mm-hmm. they're going to rename it, and she's going to have a legacy throughout the rest of the series now, just like, you know, Zeke and everybody before them.
Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely
Deke, not Zeke. Deke.
I liked it. I mean, the other thing that was kind of a letdown is the whole bombing scenario. I feel like by the time you knew what was happening, it had happened. And I know that that's the case with a bomb, right? Like the bomb goes off, it surprises everybody. Nobody's around to see a bomb go off if they know it's a bomb that's going to go off. So I don't know. It felt like, unlike previous seasons where the entire episode tells you what's going to happen and what, you know, sets up the scenario for disaster here, and then they subvert it in the final seconds. This is the inverse of that, right? Like, the episode doesn't really tell you exactly what's going to happen. There's just some ominous feeling the whole time. And then by the time you know what's going to happen, it's happened and it's catastrophic. They didn't subvert it. So this is a different kind of finale, and I really enjoyed it. It's just I probably not as good as the season 2 finale, in my opinion.
Boy, it's hard to beat. It's hard to beat Gordo remembering he's been jogging. He's taken up jogging. that was a pretty good. But I don't know, man. This finale, I think, definitely goes toe to toe with that one emotionally. There's just a lot of like individually really good scenes collectively. The fact that there's so much relationship built between, you know, the Russians at this point. I mean, that's one of the points that they make over and over again, too. These two nations struggling with each other to dominate each other in space is having the effect of wielding the actual crews ever closer together. Like, this is we talked about, you know, who is going to win, you know, is going to be the private approach, is going to be the NASA approach, is going to be the Russian approach. Actually, it's a fucking North Korean. Best Korea. Mm-hmm. Best Korea got to Mars faster, planted a flag. But I think the synthesis is like the dev is kind of like they have the Harambe. They have the everyone working together. And it wasn't top down. It was just something that like was forged in this crucible that they had to survive together. I don't know. I thought there's something beautiful in that. And that the overall theme mm-hmm. of the show is that even though there's, you know, countries and nations are as divided as other, that like people, you know, people want to work together.
Yeah. And that seems to be, you know, the general message of this show. I think like NASA being under attack this season, you know, both politically and financially, and also like literally under attack from terrorists, it indicates that. But like last season, right, the finale was all about the handshake. Like, are Danielle and this Russian cosmonaut going to defy orders from their superiors and do this wonderful thing for humanity? And of course they do.
And it's also this big, like, the public gesture versus the private that we'll never find out about, of Ed refusing to blow up the Russian shuttle. And there's like all kinds of like that kind of politics. And I don't know, because like the stuff like this here is muted. Like, there's a lot of interesting ironies. The fact that, you know, Margo finally gets Sergei out, gets him to America, and they have a chance maybe to build something besides this professional relationship finally. And yet, because of things they did a decade ago, she now has to go to Russia. Mm-hmm. And I also thought like that was a pretty effective reveal too, that I thought Margot died. And I'm like, this is actually a pretty good end for this character. This feels right, you know, in terms of like what you suffer versus what you
end. She's at her piano and when she gets blown up. Sure.
It's going to be instant. She's just gone. So she doesn't have to. Her legacy is not going to be this, that, and the other. But the fox, she slipped the coop. She ran off. Mm-hmm. Was she just telling a bald-faced lie to Elaida when she says, hey, we're going to talk about all this when it's over?
I don't know. That's a good question. Because it could be that, or it could just be that she had not made up her mind yet about what she was going to do, or she had intended. No, it's probably a lie, because she knew she was going to be arrested ASAP, right?
Right.
So,
but she could have that conversation later from jail. I don't. Okay, sure. Well, the other thing is, like, if she made it out, like would Russia try to keep that secret that they kidnapped, or I guess like they expatriated Margot, or
probably,
or because I wondered if, like, you know, Russia was like, oh yeah, you can, you know, once we get you out of the country, you can talk, or blah blah blah, but. Yeah, I was like, well, maybe then the idea that she could be dead is like too good for them to give up, and like, well, no, you can't have any contact now.
Yeah,
but
that's what I assume.
Yeah, because it's a big deal. It's a big deal taking a citizen from a sovereign country, you know. just the CIA flying you out of it. It's going to be frowned upon.
Mm-hmm. And there are other big events, so we should probably get into the recap.
I mean, as like I said, it's a 90-minute episode. There'll be lots of stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, we start off with the North Korean mission to Mars. Crash lands on February 8th, 1995. Crash lands on Mars, I should say, not on Earth, which you might also expect. One pilot is killed while the other survives for months, unable to communicate with anyone. And he's about to take his own life when he sees Danielle and Gregory's rover, Grigori. And then he holds him at gunpoint. We're caught up to where we were last episode.
Yeah, I thought this scene, we talked about how silly the idea was of this guy making it on this unmanned probe. Turns out it's a Soyuz capsule, at least that's the landing. I mean, there's been lots of people talking, and I've been thinking about it myself. It's like, well, okay, can a person survive on Mars? if you tell me that they're going to have a two-man capsule and they're going to, one of them's going to die, so this guy that's left has now got twice as much supplies and water and oxygen. He doesn't have a communication ability, so he can't talk to his home base and come up with a plan. He knows, like, I don't know that he thought that he knew he's on a suicide mission. Do you think that the Koreans' plan was to land somewhere in Happy Valley and hitch a ride back? Or if they had word that their astronaut or their, you know, cosmonauts, tychonauts, whatever they call them, had successfully landed, they have a mission ready to come get them?
I can't imagine that. That seems no way. It seemed like they barely got these people down to Mars. There was no way they were getting them back up on the steam of their own space program.
This guy didn't feel like he was on a suicide mission, though. You know, like, it wasn't just land and they were doing soil samples. They were conducting experiments. You know, he had a girl that and maybe North Korea is like, well, fuck it. These guys are probably going to die there. And, you know, glory to Korea and what on. I don't know that they're.
At best, you could drop supplies to them. I don't know, man. The state of their space program did not seem like they were capable of a rescue operation. Or a retrieval operation. But what do I know?
But I thought this is a very effective montage. We get to introduce the Lieutenant Lee here. You know, I love the steady drop in his demeanor and enthusiasm as he does the, you know, this is me. I've completed our mission for a great nation, and that, like, the enthusiasm and wanes as the, you know, you can't get a signal fixed.
As the smell of exhausted cans of food. Pile,
yeah. If you're going to throw him somewhere, why not on the surface of Mars? I guess,
right? Yeah,
it seems like it's I guess
first person to land maybe shits it up. That's the human way.
The joint team on the other side blown up a mountain and buried all kinds of shit on Mars. So, like, yeah, I think this guy can throw a couple packs of fucking tuna dumplings or whatever they are. But I like the progression of, like, his beard, him falling and hurting himself, frustration, giving up using the chopsticks. I like the locked pine box slowly becoming a menacing thing in his mind. And then we find out it's, of course, a pistol and...
I assume the North Koreans saw what happened on the moon and decided, hey, if these people are going to be up here eventually, we need to send a gun because look at these lunatics.
Or was it for literally for suicide? Like, that was, like, once the mission, because if once the mission's over, you both shoot each other and then you're done.
Sure. I guess if he knows he's on a suicide mission. Yeah.
The smile on the regolith and the way that all I was debating with myself whether he was laughing because he'd finally found peace of the situation or was he going insane.
Yeah.
The subsequent watches, I started leaning more into the insane. It was very, you know, Jack Nicholson Joker seeing his face for the first time, kind of.
Yeah.
That kind of peals of laughter.
Totally.
And like I said, this is the first scene where I noticed that, like, this Jeff, I think it's Jeff Russo is the composer for the show. Was talking about, or I started thinking, like, oh my god, this guy's like Max Richter-esque in the way that he can tickle those ivories and make you want to blow your brains out, because I was right there at that North Korean guy, you know, and then he sees.
Not a fan of Jeff Russo's thematic work. I think he does a great job in these types of moments, where he doesn't need a strong melody to carry you through it. He can just kind of put some stuff down on piano, but man, his theme songs for the Star Trek stuff have left me wanting, as has the For All Mankind theme song. I don't think it's bad. I think it's just weak melodies.
Correct. It's not. He does what it needs to be done to underpin the action, but yeah, you're right. He doesn't, you know, we talked about this on all the different Star Trek shows or whatnot, but I want to give him props because I felt like he was a lot of why the emotional stuff really hit hard in this episode. And they needed, because I was coming into this episode kind of arms crossed, eyes narrowed at this plot, and they needed for me to connect with this guy, and I needed to kind of get him because the rest of the episode, he's going to be used essentially for comedy prop, for, you know, as a comedy prop. Yeah. But They did, I think, give him their due respect here.
And for Ed to flex a little bit, flex his brain.
God, oh, man, quit spoiling all the great scenes, man. Fucking love. I learned a little bit of Korean in the war.
We'll talk about that when we get there. You know what makes me angry in this scene? It's the line, what? You are trespassing. Specifically that line, because what does that even mean? We're on an alien planet. How far from your ship is considered your land? Like, if you're the first person here, do you get all of Mars? Like, what is trespassing in this scenario? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I think there's actually international space treaties that have something to say about that. But that, I mean, I guess that's part of the thing is that certainly there's been trespassing in years past on a celestial object that such as the moon. So you could kind of say that this guy learned all this stuff from watching the bigger brothers fighting over the dinner table. Yeah, no,
needs the gun. He knew he needed the gun. One way or
so
another.
I want to talk about, before we move on, the similarities, how much foreshadowing went into that last scene we saw last season, the finale of season 2, where, you know, they're playing Nirvana, and we're going to the red planet. We see the enormous dust storm that was impeding Danielle and Ed's efforts. We see that the North Korea, this site is just on the leading edge of that storm front. They just got there a couple days early before the storm settled in. It's the exact frame by frame shot. It's not the exact shot because at least on our review copy, this was still like an animatic. It was unfinished. It wasn't completely textured and lighting and all that stuff. So they redid this shot, but it's the exact same, like the blue stripe running down the suit. We should have known that either they had just decided to retcon their show's history, which is what I thought, or that this was a hint that the first man and woman wrestling on Mars was a whole sham job. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I thought there was a lot of really cool. Also, at the point where you first see the Korean officer, the lieutenant, Nirvana's Kurt Cobain saying, "And I don't have a gun," which was people were obsessing over on a subreddit for a week. I just thought it was really cool that they had all that stuff baked into that, what I thought was just a throwaway tease of Mars in season 2.
Yeah, no, they knew where they were going, apparently. All right, let's move over to the vice president paying Ellen a visit to suggest that she resign under threat of a nasty impeachment, and she says she'd rather destroy the Republican Party than resign. It needs a little destroying.
This felt a little bit like wish fulfillment, that, you know, you would have one of the two major parties just decide before things get terminal, let's just refactor everything.
Sure.
I don't know. It felt a little bit like I said, fan service.
And that Ellen could call this idiot out for what he really is. That was the fan servicey part for me, too.
Yeah,
because he doesn't give a shit about her. Come on, her legacy.
And apparently, that's his. He's trying to get secure the party support by saying, "Yeah, I'll sign that NASA bill. We will strip the power." Right. I had a big question about where NASA is at the end of the season, because you've got their leader is a spy, but I don't think anyone will know it outside of a handful of individuals. It's not public information. You've got like the objective failure of the Mars program, but they have to at least send a Sojourner 2 or they're going to let all those people die. Kelly, which he's saying is like this tawdry Soviet love child, Martian love baby. But I think it's clearly captured the American public.
Especially now that no astronauts died for it. Yeah.
And then the Johnson Space Center gets exploded, which I think is going to have people's sides on their sympathy. I really do. Yeah. I'm very curious about what NASA looks like in 8 years.
Yeah, it seems like it would be hard to defund NASA after the events at JSC. I would think publicly.
It would seem like kicking something when it's down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that saved it in a strange way.
Plus the astronaut being a famous, or the president, even though she came out as gay and America doesn't know quite what to think about that. She is a heroic astronaut, and like Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people she knows were friends with, went through their, you know, the training program, the Apollo 13 training program together. I wonder if that helps to soften, you know, it's like anyone is going to get up and be like, oh, Flores, you lied about being gay, is going to be like, ah, boy, she's going through a lot right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if that factors in.
Attack somebody who just lost a bunch of her friends. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, we go over to Karen trying to visit Wayne, but Molly's the only one home. And eventually she tells Molly about her dilemma, which is whether to throw Dev under the bus and take his job. And Molly tells her to be a selfish prick. Selfish pricks change the world, she says. And she's not wrong, but the question in my mind remains, do selfish pricks change the world for the better or for the worse?
Well, this particular potential selfish prick ain't changing shit, except for her distance below ground ratio. So like a lot of this is like a little academic at this point, because both these selfish pricks.
By the end of the episode, they're both dead.
I did love this because this is another one of the moments of sly comedy. I mean, this is like awkward on the level of when Jesse Pinkman had dinner with the Whites that one time on Breaking Bad. Like, she's trying to compliment her paintings, like that's actually Wayne's corner, and you know, then she starts doing her Karen thing where she's like quietly cleaning up their like weed table, and Molly's like, I can't, I'm blind, but I can feel the shit radiating off you. And she gives Karen, I think, some good advice. If you're in a businessman, you gotta be a businessman. You gotta put all this personal shit behind you, and if you want something, you gotta take it. I mean, like, it's not like the board's gonna be like, gee, Karen, you gave us a lot to think about, we'll keep him in place. Like, you can fall fall on Dev's sword with him and both be shown the door. But I thought that was really, you know, when she talked about that Gordo situation. Like, I took Gordo's thing he trained for years for. Did I worry that he's going to not like me or that he was going to get his feelings hurt? Fuck no. I rode that rocket, found ice on the moon. So,
yeah, I mean, so there's always a third path, right? I mean, she could stand with Dev and fight. I mean, if his plea to his team worked in this episode and everybody decided they were either going to continue the Mars mission at Helios or do a walkout, I'm pretty sure Helios would continue their Mars missions. You know, can Dev and Karen put up that big of a fight? Probably not. But, you know, there is an option. You know, she doesn't have to be a selfish prick, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't have to just surrender here. She could fight with Dev, but I mean, I take Molly's meaning, too. Like, I also agree the board is not likely to back down. So, do you want to throw yourself on your own sword for Dev, or do you want to take the job that's been offered to you? It's a dilemma, for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much she owes the right Dev. Choice. Like, that's the thing. I never felt like they were especially close or she particularly owed him. Like,
no, they've known each other for less than a year. Right? Uh-huh. About a year and a half max.
And she says she owes him, but I don't very strongly agree with that. I think, like, yeah, he gave her a job at Helios, but it's not like she was in a bad place. It's not like Aleta, right? Where, like, she owes Margo something because Margo bet on her when no one else would.
Yeah.
She was a fucking ultra successful businesswoman with probably hundreds of millions of dollars from her last venture. Why does she owe this man anything? I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think that she is that, like Molly said, you know, you've always wanted to be the selfish person, but you've had all this 1950s astronaut housewife bullshit in your head that you needed to get deprogrammed. And part of that is like, yeah, like most men in her position wouldn't even think twice, like business associate over so I can get more power and money. Like, yeah, that's the whole point. So like Molly, I think, is doing her, like I said, I don't know that that's the be all end all of human endeavors, but it's certainly the way things are done down to this day. And if you're going to play in that world, then you either need to play by those rules or you'll be the person, you know, with the knife in the gunfight, because people said that you're supposed to be sporting in these type of events. Like, no, it's a dogfight.
Yeah. But I don't know. Change for the sake of change has never been something I'm interested in. I want change to better our society, better people, better us somehow.
Sure.
You know, just changing things because you're being a selfish prick just to change something to your POV doesn't actually entice me.
And it's also not the total story with Molly, because she also selflessly put her body on the line to save that goofy Danish astronaut whose name, what's his name, like Wooby Woober Wooberson?
The like, fuck?
It was some kind of, it was some kind of very Dutch or Norwegian name that I thought was Wooby. I thought it was Wooby. But she lost her career because she drugged that guy to cover under a scorching solar flare storm on the moon. Okay. Yeah. So like, it's not that she is just a selfish prick full time. She takes her advantage, but like, I think that maybe that's the difference between her and Dev and Karen, is that I don't, would Dev put himself on the line like that?
Right.
To save somebody else's, he wouldn't put a start. He definitely didn't put a starship on the line when he was in that position.
Uh-huh.
So I thought it's an interesting contrast, because like, yeah, and that's because it's like, what is the show's thesis? Is the show that you should be selfish pricks and take every advantage and step over people to get in the way? Or is it more the Harambe type of thing? And I think like, even Molly's kind of like half and half. She's not purely selfish prick, or she wouldn't be blind. She'd probably be commanding the Mars mission.
And look at the way she dies, right? She died
exactly
going back into a burning building to save people. So
for an institution that had kicked her in the teeth and thrown her out. You know, she was there as a personal favor to her friend Ed Baldwin and ended up saving a bunch of people's lives at the Johnson Space Center. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I said, it's very subtle stuff, but I think it's important.
All right. Up on Mars, Dimitri, the space doctor, tells Ed they have 24 hours to deliver Kelly's baby, or both the baby and Kelly risk death. They don't have the fuel to launch the MSAM yet, though. So it's a big old dilemma.
Did you think it was sexist the way the Russian doctor pulled Ed away to talk about Kelly's condition? I want to get to the bottom. As two men, I think we should get to the bottom of this.
And then the women listening can this.
FAM at baldmove.com. You can rate how we do.
Uh-huh.
I'll go first. I'll say that a life-threatening pregnancy on Mars is maybe the one case where you could take someone aside that's not the person involved and talk about the risks and stuff, and then talk about how you're going to approach that with them. I'm not saying that you never bring Kelly back in, but like,
but he's the commander of the mission.
She's got pre-eclamp. Like, why say, be like, you know, we don't get this baby out of you, and we have no way to do that, and get you to the starship in 24 hours, which again, we're a month away from.
Right.
You and your child are going to die, and we have no answers for you.
And also, your blood pressure is a little high right now, so if you could just calm down and bring that down a little bit, that'd be great.
I feel like accident, like trauma victims, the same way. Like, if you're fighting for your life, maybe take the husband or wife or the son or daughter aside and explain what the mother, father, husband, wife is going through, so you can, you know, because like, their attention is full up on like dealing with their personal crisis. I don't know. I felt like it wasn't, especially since like, it's not like they just strapped her to the top of that thing and launched her up and didn't get her full. Yeah. They eventually could, but like the first time I watched, I'm like, this is kind of weird that they're let's have a conversation away from the little lady. But I feel like on other watches, I'm like, no, that's probably something I can get behind.
Is Ed just the de facto commander of Happy Valley now? Like, there's some
no Daniel's but he is the father station,
so like
I think if Alexi was alive, he'd be having his conversation with Alexi, but he's not, and
maybe
Ed's here, but like, Ed is a commander and he's her father, and I think through Russian or math that makes him in charge.
Okay. And the other two commanders,
which
are
that is definitely sexist
moment,
but
so.
yeah
I don't know if it's sexist or not, but it's what happens. And it leads to a pretty outstanding scene later in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to get there. Danielle and Gregory realize that their North Korean captor was the first man on Mars. It turns out, And Danielle tries to explain to him with sand diagrams what their intentions are. She seems to be getting through to him, but then Gregory sneaks up behind him, unplugs his arrows, and takes his gun. Danielle saves the man, and they bury the gun, load up the equipment and their new prisoner, and head back.
Yeah, crewmate. I'm not sure what to call this guy either. And it's a topic of discussion the yeah. episode.
Ellen's
I thought
sure
this
either.
Scene. I thought this scene was hilarious. The look of the commander, the Russian commander, Gregory, and Danielle's face as they're sitting there at gunpoint with this North Korean has no idea what the hell he's doing. Mm-hmm. And they're like going back and forth. And then they realize that he beat them to the mark and they start hysterically laughing. And then they show the North Koreans guys like, these guys are all glum because I took him prisoner. And now they're just laughing like the Joker. What the hell is going on? His confusion was great.
They've got the space madness. Better shoot him before it spreads, man.
I like the Russian cosmonaut, the commander, kind of filling in the blanks about like why North Korea might do something like this. Like they have kind of a national insecurity. They want to prove that they're a world power, but also they're afraid that they'll embarrass themselves. So this is all hush hush, very secret. They probably don't even know the guy's alive. Mm-hmm. And then Danielle's attempts to do this pantomime. You know, she's playing. What is that? Cranium on Mars, trying to make himself out. And then the Russian guy, once the Korean gets engrossed in the game, just pulls his air hose off.
Yeah, yeah.
And they play Connection by Elastica as a hilarious, which I think is hilarious because he pulls the guy's connection. They're making this connection. And the way the Russian commander just smiles, his like wolfish smile once he gets in, he like poses with his gun like James Bond. Yeah, I thought it's great. I'm starting to really warm up to this guy.
Yeah, I suppose so. Now that he's not being a total shit to Danielle the whole time.
He's not being a giant prick. He is. He's kind of, or he's using his prick powers for good.
Sure. This gun gets buried with a tire iron marking the location. This is 100% going to come back, especially with Danny being sent to man the North Korean outpost, right?
Is this the bag of cash on Fargo? Where every season of Fargo, we're like, where is, no, it's still out there. It's still out there by the highway. There's still that red windshield wiper monument to it.
Every season we're wrong.
I wondered because like, so here's something. Danny could use it to escape his exile, but like, we're clearly going forward 8 years. Like the sandstorms will bury this inevitably. What is this Chekhov's North Korean gun on Mars?
I assume Danny will find it. Like, we'll come back 8 years later. But 8 years later, Danny's off Mars. He's not staying on Mars for 8 years. The Sojourner 2
might be in jail or something.
Prison.
But yeah. Yeah. So, I wonder if he's criminally negligent. He might be court-martialed. And I guess that would be. But like, I'm trying to think if he committed like workplace negligence. If someone showed up drunk and high and killed someone, are they criminally? They might be.
Maybe.
They might be.
Depends on.
I know if you like did that on your personal time and you hit someone drunk driving, it's clear cut. You got criminal liability there. But like on a workplace, I don't know. For the federal government?
I don't know. So yeah, you're probably right. It's not going to come back, but it seems strange that it wouldn't come back.
Yeah, I mean, everything in there tells me this is important. It's coming. We're coming back later. This is going to like, we're marking a point where it is. And then I kept on expecting it was going to be needed somehow. Like,
I mean, maybe it
at
will
one
come
point
back,
I like, thought is Ke- I, when they're trying to figure out the second stage, I'm like, is Kelly going to like have a gun and like firing rounds backwards to get that extra impulse and
propulsion? Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, they didn't do that.
I guess it could be there for 8 years and then someone in the North Korean outpost could take it, could use it for something. Like, I don't think anybody else on Mars has a gun. I think, I don't want to say they learned
years?
Their lesson on the moon, but they didn't send any guns as best I can tell to Mars. But eight years is a long damn time. I know.
I think the gun can be fresh for 8 years. I think that gun could probably be fresh for hundreds of years on buried a foot beneath Mars.
It's just how you find it. Like a metal detector? Yeah. Are they going to send one of those up?
Although I will say that the dust storms of Mars are not like, it's not like they're moving feet of material around. Because again, the Martian atmosphere, even though you hear like, oh, Martian dust storms whipping at 400 miles an hour. That's at like 1/100th of the air pressure that we experience at sea level. So a 400 mile wind would feel something like a 15 mile an hour breeze if you were running around naked out of Mars. It just doesn't have the strength to pick up like heavy material like that thing that's actually anti-science, the beginning of Martian, where the windstorm picks up a large metal structure and impales an astronaut with it. That's just not going to happen. It'll cover your fucking solar panels in a fine dust, so you got to clean them off or they won't work anymore, and you got to do a bunch of stuff. But like, I don't know that this thing would be buried. It's sticking a foot out of the ground. So I guess it's going to come back, and we'll see how and why.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of funny if it's a monument to international peace. That would be a really slick way.
I was wondering if they were, using it as like a flag planting sort of thing, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, an international peace monument, I suppose.
I think that would be inappropriate if we come back to Happy Valley next season and that's like, built up a little bit, kind of the way they had the, was it Deke that they had the grave on the moon for? It'd be cool if they had something kind of like that, and then it just keeps growing in years past or in seasons past.
All right, Ellen gets the news about the North Koreans on Mars, and she worries about what to do about both her situations. I think she's talking to Mikhail Gorbachev here.
Yep,
that's what I assumed, because she calls him Mikhail a few times.
And we've seen him this year in Mikhail Gorbachev in camera with her. So,
oh, when was that?
They're doing a statement about the fact that the Americans are going to pick up the Russians and it's going to be a joint operation. He came to the White House and there was this doctored footage of him, with the fictitious Ellen.
Right. But not a big scene there.
What do you think about his the Russian proverb, I ran from the wolf but ran into the bear?
I mean, out of the frying pan into the fire, right? That's essentially what that saying is.
I felt like this is anything that takes away from the gay hysteria facing her would be like the opposite of a bear. Would be like, I ran from the wolf but then ran into a wolf hunter and he killed the wolf and everything was okay. like there's nothing that can,
but it's a
but
tragedy,
good can
right?
come from the rush from the North Korean guy.
Well, I mean, they've lost their claim to Mars, to being the first people on Mars. So like, I could see him like thinking that's a pretty big deal. And then by the end of the episode, there's a fucking bear for sure.
I wonder if it was, do you think he was kind of like low key warning her about what was coming?
Maybe.
Like, cause he knows, right? In this conversation, he knows that he's got the NASA's chief administrator in his pocket.
Yeah, you could be right. He's playing a little sly here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Speaking of NASA administrators in pockets, Katish tells Margo that she's being investigated by the FBI and offers to help. And Margo does not really give an answer here. She just kind of looks into the middle distance.
Margo, this is your last chance to off ramp. The Russians have admitted that they have an asset high in the Justice Department. You could bring that information to the Justice Department and offer to help expose.
Damn.
As a one-to-one toe. And you just like all these opportunities just keep, she just keeps, she's like Jack Sparrow. She likes waving as she passes them and says goodbye.
I didn't even think about trading that for immunity for sure.
There's something, I don't know. Like, God damn, living the rest
of
your
know
life.
Who it is though. She just knows there is an asset. Like,
no,
then
you
have
just bring
to do,
that would be valuable information, and I bet there's ways. Like I said, I'm not a counterintelligence expert, but do you know who is? The FBI and the CIA.
I feel like the DOJ should always be assuming there's a spy in their ranks and always be canary trapping
right.
and
right.
fucking, you know, dead dropping shit. They should be acting like everyone on staff is a spy.
No, high level espionage is really fascinating, and it must be said that Soviets were always very, very good at it.
Oh yeah.
They were they were very good at spycraft.
Indeed. That KGB really knew how to embed a spy. And then the Helios team tries to figure out how to get the fuel they need to get the MSAM back to the Phoenix. And Dev pulls Karen aside to convince her to join him in a last-ditch effort to save his company. Karen says, actually, the board's going to be replacing you with me. And, of course, he's pissed off.
Let me show you this card that I'm carrying. Oh, look, it says I'm a selfish prick and I get to do this.
She tries to be the nicest version of a selfish prick. She does. But she's still.
She tries to give him the soft landing of like, hey, you're still on the board and I'm still on your side. And, you know, if we play this right, we can. And he's like, nah, I'm not going to have it.
I keep hearing her say our company. And every time she says our company, I expect Dev to say, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah, I built this company from nothing.
Yeah,
you dick. This is not our company. It's my company. But he's
I thought that was consistently through the whole conversation. He is my company, my company. She's our company, our company. So she's and I thought like I thought she's trying to build common cause with him, that this wasn't like an usurpation of like, oh, I did. You know, it's more of like, hey, I believe in this just as much. But that's
but it comes across as so nakedly what she's doing that I thought Dev would take offense to it.
It does. And also, like, it's just also, I think it is offensive when someone, you know, you haven't worked your ass off like Dev. Like, Dev's been doing this stuff at college. Like, Dev invented nuclear fusion with his buddy. Like, you had a space hotel that almost killed everyone, you know?
Right. And we bought, like, we saved your company by buying your ship. Yeah. Your busted ass ship.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tricky, but I, you know, like I said, I'm a bit on more on Karen's side. I don't know why. I guess because I trust her more. Well, but she's dead. I keep on like, yeah, there's just not.
Yeah.
What? So I guess this is their way of preserving Dev as a character, because it seems likely that he's going to survive into next season. Helios isn't going to get to abandon their Mars base.
Damn.
Yeah, like this probably between Karen dying and leaving a leadership vacuum and NASA being forced to commit to support the Helios operation. I wonder if that's enough to save him, gives him enough room to maneuver, gets sympathy on the world stage, too. Like, you know, here's his people are making this huge sacrifice to make sure one, you know, tragically single mother is going to be able to have a shot raising her child. I don't know.
And it has to be a multi-year mission at this point. They have years to think about it, right? Because, you know, they can't just take the Phoenix back to Earth. They've got 9 astronauts stranded on the planet. You can't abandon them, right? You have to stay there. Whether you can get access to them or not, you have to stay there.
Oh no! I think Phoenix is coming back for sure.
You
think? Oh, yeah, I think Sojourner can do it all by herself. But here's the way to look at it. There's nothing the Phoenix can now that the MSAM is wrecked. Truly, there's nothing the Phoenix can do to support these people. The only thing they can do is cause a problem that needs more people to be rescued.
But the optics of abandoning 9 people on the planet of Mars. I don't know. That seems like bad optics to me, but. What do I know?
I feel like it wouldn't bother. I mean, because I guess if you either understand the situation or you don't. If you don't, you look at it like, oh, you abandoned your people. But like, you know.
Yeah, personally, I would say, yeah, abandon them. Because like, if there's literally nothing you can do, then it's pointless to stay there with this baby getting irradiated in space for sure. But like.
To me, people abandoning is like is that scene at in the Master and Commander where like the mast has gone off the ship and there's a dude up there and he's trying to swim back, but it's drowning the ship and they got to cut him free. He's going to drown. This is more like there's not enough room on the ship and we're going to put a lifeboat out here and leave you guys out here to chill. And there's no way we can come back to get you either way. So we're going to go back home and help with the rescue. Like, it's like that's not my definition of like. Stranding someone.
No, I agree.
Although I know it's literally a plain reading of what's happening here.
No, I agree. I'm very sympathetic to the idea that they should just come back home. But like I said, the public doesn't always see it that way. You know, you have psychos who are out there bombing buildings Gordo and
what's the real reason they left all those men and women on the ground? They saw the green men.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the other thing that's happening in this scene when Karen is talking to Dev here is she's reinforcing this idea that Dev doesn't actually care about the people that he's pretending to care about. She says the people you claim to care so much about. And then, you know, he throws it back. Oh, so you're doing this for them, no one else. And of course, she has to say no. But I think what they're setting up here is the scene later where Dev tries to talk his team into joining him on a new venture and walking out of Helios and does not fill them in on all the details about how that would work with the pay cuts and giving up stock options and what it would cost them. And Karen's there to point that out to show that you're actually not doing this all for the people that you claim to care so much about either. So I think there's a nice symmetry there and it really works later on. So then we go over to Ed explaining that they need to cut 1,000 more pounds out of the MSAM to get it up to the Phoenix with the amount of fuel they have. Turns out the crew members weigh just about 1,000 pounds. And over Kelly's objections, they all volunteer to stay behind for a year and a half to get her up to the Phoenix on the next pass. And then Ed informs NASA.
I think there's going to be some people trying to do some body math and trying to figure out that, like, well, actually, they probably could have brought three people. And I'm like, man, they also had to weld a big old metal structure to the top of this to hold Kelly. I was like, I think it's within the realm of don't fucking worry about it. You know, like, do you want to save this young woman and her baby or not? You know, also, and once you decide.
Yeah, you're right. And also, this is a Nine Musketeers situation, right? Like, one for all for one. They can't, like, pick and choose who's actually going to go back up to the Phoenix and go home.
Well, so I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. But the way I look at it as an astronaut is this way. If we could get more people up there, I would gladly have them because that means more food for me, more non-recycled piss water for me. More CO2,
clearly
normal
CO2. Concern,
yeah,
though. They don't even go over like, well, do we have enough food? Are we going to be able to recycle enough?
Yeah,
water
they just say
us?
That like, yeah, if we just ration and the crops come, it's going to be fine. And I imagine it will be. But they might be a little bit Mark Watney at the end of The Martian.
We probably won't know because we skip all that 8 years to 2003. So
I imagine we'll get oblique references like, oh, remember that 1 year when we, you know. You don't know tough, like, yeah, I imagine, but yeah, we won't. I imagine we'll know if one of them dies.
For one of the people who starves to death or something up there. I mean,
yeah,
maybe
Skinny
Will.
Valley, they'll rename it.
Yeah, Skinny Valley, sure. Starvation Alley. The news reports live from Johnson Space Center, and Jimmy's friends send him inside to plant a device on the broadcast system. This plan doesn't really pay off, but the thing I could gather from this scene is that they were going to send some kind of message into the facility as they were bombing it.
I think the idea was because, like, you know, when you have big launches and stuff like that, NASA provides a feed to the media that they essentially they carry. And I think what they were going to do is hijack that and give, like, you know, a jihad style mission statement and then blow themselves up. I think that's what they were going to do. This is just you know, textbook terrorism. They were going to have a message and then be martyrs and blow, because they clearly were planning on blowing themselves up. I don't think that they were going to leave the area, although I don't know, maybe they would. Maybe they're going to record something and have it set up and rig the play. Because they did. Why would you want a remote detonator if you're just going to blow it up outside the van? Maybe they did have a plan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, I think that's what it was. They're going to hijack NASA's signal. It's going to go out inadvertently to all, like, simultaneously live, and then the building would blow up. But Jimmy fucked it up.
Yeah.
Jimmy unwittingly kept them from, deploying the psychological part of their payload.
Yeah, which is nice. They're having no luck coming up with an idea to get the MSAM the other 5% of the way to the Phoenix. So Margo calls Aleta out into the hall She's pretty distracted. And Elena tries to confess about the investigation, but turns out Margot already knows. And Margot says, we'll talk after this is over, but right now we need to focus. Then Elena comes up with an idea to use Kelly's PMU, which is Propulsive Mobility Unit, to essentially her jetpack, to get her the rest of the way to the Phoenix.
I haven't seen a more pregnant we'll talk once this is all over since Sean Bean said goodbye to Jon Snow in season one of Game of Thrones, when this blows over, I'll tell you all about your mother, kid. Uh-huh. Except for Ned didn't mean to leave that thing dangling. I think Margot, plain reading, is she intentionally just ducking this? You're never going to know.
Yeah, she knows one way or another she's not coming out of this situation in the way she entered it. So, like,
let me ask you this.
They could have a prison conversation, but that's going to be years down the line once her trial's over, all that stuff. This
is stupid, maybe, and I'm just coming off of just literally having this idea. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility that Russia funded or put up this kind of, like, dissident group and they intentionally, like, use them as cover to steal Margot?
I mean, it's possible. We don't really see the origins, right? The Jimmy just meets these people kind of in the middle of
I mean, I get that, like, domestic bombing is way different than, like, you know, fucking around on Facebook and manipulating, you know, bots and stuff like that. But it's probably not. It's probably just something that literally was opportunistic, you know?
Yeah, and I think this is much more... The thing they're going for here is the Timothy McVeigh stuff.
Yeah.
The Oklahoma City bombing.
Anti-government dissidents, essentially.
Yeah, which... I don't think the Russians were involved in that, but I could be wrong.
Who knows?
World may never know. This is a batshit insane plan, and I love it. This is the kind of out-of-the-box thinking that will take you places, Elena, and already has taken you places.
Yeah,
I'm with government issue face man, whoever this guy is, who says, like, wait, let me get this straight. You basically want to turn this woman into a rocket.
Yeah, yep. Light her up.
Mm-hmm.
I also love how they left the room and everything was, like, calm and orderly, and they come back and, like, Bill screaming at NASA, you crashed your damn ship. And they're like, well, you blew up a mountain. And they're, like, at each other's throats, and Margo's got to, like, I got my listen to what Elena has to say.
The Russians in here. We can get to first causes.
Yeah.
But actually, Margo's in the room. Never mind. It's fine.
And I'm like, man, what is this going to look like? And I start, you know, you start thinking, and the show, I think, does a really good job of, like, addressing all your concerns. Like, how are you going to strap a woman to the front of a rocket? And, well, there's very little atmosphere in Mars, so it's not like, you know, it's going to be like riding around something that we saw last year in the back of the LSAM, the Lunar Surface Access Module. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just kind of, like, deal one by one. Well, does it have enough fuel, or build a framework so it has more fuel? By the time I thought this was a pretty plausible way to do this one thing, I do wonder what kind of G's they were pulling and what kind of effect that would have on a preeclampsic woman in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Clearly I'm not supposed to be thinking that hard, and also this is her only shot. She either gets to the ship and gives birth, or her and her baby die, so, you know,
shoot your shot.
Yeah. But I felt like they could have accentuated that part of the danger, because it felt like all the danger was, like, can Ed get her to orbit? Can she hit the, but, like, you know, I could have used the one of those montage scenes of a journalist talking to a NASA flight surgeon talking about the risks of a G-force. So I think that would just elevate the tension, you know?
I wanted Bill to say also, if she misses, she's just gone. Like, she's going to be floating in space.
She'll be the first woman who delivers a child in a spacesuit, and 3 hours later they'll die. Yeah, that would be that wouldn't look good on the front page of any headline.
No. There are any number of things that could have gone wrong here. I don't know. It seems like a crazy plan, but it is the only plan. So
yeah,
go with it. And that's the story of the space program in this show, right? We have no plan. Oh, shit. Here's a plan. That's a terrible plan. Let's do it.
Yeah, it's all Apollo 13 all the time on this show.
Yep, I love it. All right, Dev tries to convince his team to leave Helios and join him in a new venture, but Karen points out how much financial hardship that would involve for themselves, and the team wavers.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, I love this scene because there is a push-pull here that I really like. I believe the Dev has a vision, and I believe in his vision. And if I'm a team member here, I'm getting excited about starting a new thing with him. I also think for my tastes, a space co-op corporation is fucking awesome. 100%, let's do that. I think all corporations, honestly, should probably be co-ops. But then you have Karen pointing out, you know, that they're going to lose a lot of the stuff they've been working for. It's not just that they can switch teams here and continue on the way they've been going. They're going to lose about $100,000, I guess, is what in stock options is what they say.
And one guy also says they take pay cuts. Yeah. With uncertain, you know, like it's not, Dev doesn't have Helios behind him. He'd be starting off from scratch. I thought this was great. It's like, it shows the difference between this guy who's ready to go, like push all his chips in the corner or all his chips in the center of the table. Because if he loses 99% of his net value,
yeah,
he'll still be amongst one of the wealthiest people in the world. These kids lose 99% of their value and they're homeless. You know, they're panhandling in Austin. They're busking. And it's where
vision and reality meet. And I think that's an interesting intersection.
And the thing is I don't know that this is malicious. I don't think that Dev went in here thinking he was going to Pied Piper these kids off to financial oblivion. It's just that he's out of touch.
He's
no longer that hungry kid in college that watched his dad make all these sacrifices. He's now thinks that it's like they said, that it's all gone to his head. His ego has gone to his head. It's out of control. And he just wants to find the thing that keeps him, his dream alive, and doesn't stop and think about the responsibilities he has to these other people.
And I don't blame him. Like, you know, it's a dream that I believe in, like I said, but I think, you know, he needs to let these people explore the possibility space here a little bit.
Right.
And then what they're going to be sacrificing. Because I'm sure he made a ton of sacrifices through college and the years after in order to get this stuff off the ground and realize his vision. But he's no longer in that place, and these people might be. So, yeah.
But he's got that, well, it's just money kind of philosophy of people that, you know, can lose 99% of their net value and still, like, you're playing with house money, never have to think about money
in their life again, right?
Exactly.
Except where it limits the wildly enormous dreams they have. That's the only time he butts up against money problems.
It's like that. Did you ever see This Is 40, that Judd Apatow movie where, who was that? It was Paul Rudd. And I forget his wife, but the whole plot is like they're going rich people broke, which means they're gonna have to sell their vacation house and choke down from a Porsche to a Volvo. And my God, what are, you know, like it's like I said, it's an interesting movie. But it's kind of like the same thing I got watching Dev talking about this is just like, a person that just doesn't understand when he's talking about, we're all making these sacrifices, we're all pulling forward. Well, you're going to be on the cover of Times. And if we go broke, we're going to be in the breadlines. That's the we and I dichotomy here. And I wonder, because I feel like they're saving Dev for a character next season. I wonder if they will come back, like Dev 2.0 will be a guy who's like blended all these different lessons together.
Could be.
He'll be self-financed. He'll go like the NASA model of like, you know, and then, you know, maybe make sure his people are also independently wealthy. So they've got, I don't know what a better Dev looks like.
Yeah. I mean, the co-op idea is a good start, right? If everybody's an owner with an equal share, like that's the true structureless organization that he was touting Helios as.
I think he's scared. I think he's afraid to give up that much control. The character growth he goes through, you know, 8 years later.
Could be.
Plus, also NASA getting like devastated. It's got to be good. You know, if you're looking for silver linings as a private investor, got to be good for the private space program. Mm-hmm. The fact that their nerve center got bombed and probably a lot of their staff, top staff was there. Like, that's going to be a huge blow. It's going to take them years to recover from. And here's Dev with his helium-3 mining operation and his buyout. It's going to be interesting to see where he lands, because I think he'll be a central figure going forward.
Yeah, could be. All right, Ed explains to Kelly the plan to launch her to the Phoenix, and she agrees to go along with it. Ed will apparently be the pilot, which worries Kelly because there will be no spare fuel for his landing.
The look on her face, her deadpan, you know, I'm going to ride to Phoenix on the top of the MSAM. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and like Ed talking about how, and then her be like, well, if it's the thing I got to do to save my baby. I thought that was priceless.
It's like riding a boogie board, you know, it's nothing. No big deal.
Yeah. And I think not unreasonably that Ed is appealing to the geniuses at NASA to save him with only 2-3% rocket fuel left to land back on Mars. And they also, when he says, and I got the best pilot I know to help us out, I fucking knew it was going to be Molly. And it was such a huge moment when she comes back. I guess I'll let you introduce the scene.
Yeah, Molly returns to NASA to help work the problem of getting Ed safely back down to Mars. That's it. And everyone gives her various welcomes.
Yeah, she gets all this dap, and she's like, all right, that's enough of this shit. Now, where's the Queen of Darkness?
She accurately predicts exactly what Ed said to get her back in. You know, she wants he wants someone who's had their ass on the line, and Margo's like, yeah, that's basically exactly what he said.
But as much personal animosity as these two women have towards each other, I thought it was nice that Margot essentially says, get this woman whatever she needs to help out Ed.
Yeah. I mean, she wants to get this job done.
These last three scenes have been the start of an unbroken just stretch of awesome for all mankind watching. I consider this all fan service. Molly getting one last go at Margot, Ed and Kelly, Molly's message to Ed. It's just such great character moments. Ed speaking Korean, which we're about to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great. Let's get there. Danielle and Grigori return to Happy Valley with their North Korean crew member. Ed is able to speak Korean to him, and he requests to go back to his post, which is just his ship, his outpost. Ed welcomes him into his new home. I love, because Ed, you can almost see like Ed's about, he's warming up to enjoy this moment, right? He's going to unleash a skill that these people had no idea he had.
Yeah, I've got something up my sleeve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What in the hell? It's so good.
Yeah. It's just a smug look he's got right before. He's like, I'm going to do a magic trick. No one knows I can juggle. No one knows I can do close magic. And this is something a consistent, like he has talked about being on the goddamn carriers in Korea with Gordo, with Tracy, with that. Even this season, he talked about like, you know, when I was in the war in Korea, I could tell, you know, talked about MASH, being in his MASH unit and all that kind of stuff. And the also thing that's great is like, he's not great at it. He knows enough to say like, what's your name? What's your deal?
Dumpling. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but
I think he's trying to say my friend, but he says, my dumpling, you know, he's not, but like, he runs out of her, but like, it's such a great Ed moment. And Joel McKinnon plays it with just the right amount of that wily Ed energy. And yeah, it is a huge, huge, huge smile on my face.
And the show itself is playing a bit of a magic trick, too, with a sleight of hand, because I had forgotten that he might speak Korean. Like when I was talking about, like, how are they going to communicate all this last episode, I did not even think that if they can get him back to the Hab, that Ed will be able to talk to him. But it makes
even though
sense.
The show has pretty consistently told us that Ed spent several years in Korea, you know?
Yeah, I guess the drama got in the way. The drama clouded my memory. Yeah, but it was great. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
And we find out this guy's name is Lee Jung-gil, which I'm just going to call him Lee. for the rest of this. Anyway, Jimmy sweats over whether to carry out the mission at NASA, and he runs into Karen and then excuses himself. And then Karen goes in and takes her place in mission control. And then outside we see, or Jimmy sees guns in the back of his friend's van, and he panics and calls Amber to let her know something is going down, and then his friends knock him out.
I thought on second watch, this scene with Karen, you know, after she scares Jimmy off from his mission and she calls Aleda over, and or Aleda calls her over, and they talk about their experiences being in the visitor booth. And, you know, she said, you know, 20 years ago, I was in that room waiting to hear if my husband would be okay. 20 years later, I'm down here waiting to hear if my husband and daughter will be okay. And on second watch, this really hit me, the inverse, because she thinks she's safe down here. Mm-hmm. And she's not going to be. And then when you get to the end where Ed's processing that, like, I was risking my life and my ex-wife is the one that died. Like, yeah. I just thought that stuff was. Yeah, especially since we've spent years, like, you know, like that's one of the things I think that they've done well with Karen is showing like what it's like to be the significant other, and with Wayne too, like, you know, what a hell. And even, you know, Jimmy and Danielle's son, like what a hell it is to have your parents be away in this harsh environment where they could just die at any time. Like mm-hmm. at no time are they safe. Like they're fucking happy. You get a leak in the middle of the night and they all suffocate. Like they did that. And then they invert it in this last season. I just thought it was such a great way to amp the emotional stakes and redouble the gut punches.
Yeah. And letting her meet Jimmy in the hall here and seeing him acting kind of weird gives her even more concern later when she gets this call from Amber.
Yeah, like the puzzle pieces are just and they just fell slightly too slow. Because I at first thought this is going to be they're going to be able to get to the bottom of this and stop it.
Right. But how do you convince a security guard in 3 seconds to pull out his gun and shoot somebody? Right.
Yeah.
Like you just, you can't. You can't.
Yeah.
I will talk about a way that it should have stopped it and a way that I would have stopped it. But we'll see.
I can't wait to hear the heroic Jim Jones spring to action.
Yeah. Put me on the newspapers. I'm not my death, my heroic ventures.
It's heroic life saving measures.
Mm hmm. Sergei calls Margot to tell her the good news that he and his family are out of Russia and headed to America. They're currently in Germany. And I love this scene because this is where the inversion really happens, right? Where it really sinks in. You're like, oh, she can't tell him that she's about to be arrested. Emotionally, she can't tell him, right? I mean, legally, whatever. She could tell him, but she chooses not to.
Well, can she? Can you imagine her saying, okay, Sergey, I'm so glad that you got it out of here. Well, I'm going to go to Moscow now and I'll see you never. Like, I just think, yeah.
That's a pretty good Margo.
I don't think.
Thank you. No, she could use coded language, right? Like, there would be a way.
Album.
Yeah, she could send him a jazz record.
Right.
He could play the Dusseldorf airport or whatever.
You know, I kind of wish that was the last. Instead of him picking up the paper, I wish Sergey had gotten a DHL delivery that was some kind of album cover and him looking at like it,
like a Doc and Marty do not deliver until 8 years later, 2003. It'd be tough to do because she doesn't know where he's gonna live. So
it's a bittersweet scene because he's talking about how giddy he is. He's escaped from the Soviet Union. He's got his whole family out. They all had this daring midnight helicopter ride to the, you know, NATO headquarters in Germany, and he's clearly pleased and he can't wait to start his life in America. Can't wait to see Margot. And, you know, from her perspective, she's being weird. I'm surprised he didn't pick up on it with the FaceTime, but I guess that would have spoiled the scene. If he's like, what's wrong? You know, it would have brought it down.
And his excitement is probably just overriding any logical, observation.
Yeah, and also on second watch when she's talking about like it's going to be an adjustment living in a new place, she's putting a brave face on for herself as much as she is delighted at Sergey.
Yeah, I think so. You think she's already made the decision to take Katisha up on the offer to help?
I think so. Okay. Because like there's like especially on second watch, I think she's even though I think she's been a real shitter this season, this character is great, and the actor portraying her, I can't remember her name, is doing a extremely good job of, I think, realistic portraying the push pull of this poor woman. You know, because like I said, it's not that I don't have sympathy. Mm-hmm. So.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, Molly sends Ed a message walking him through the landing on Mars that he's going to have to make, when to fire his thrusters, and how to know when it's time. And then she explains how hard this is going to be to Karen. And then Amber calls Karen to tell her about the strange voicemail from Jimmy.
Again, I love the video thing that Molly sent to Ed. Like, I don't really know what it means. Like, it seems like it's all a bunch of test pilot shit. You know, you can't trust your eyes. You can't trust your instruments. When you know what you can trust, you can trust your horizon. And you second too soon, you're this. A second too late, you're that. And then her saying, yeah, it's a good thing you're at the end of your career, Ed. You don't got much to look forward to anyway. Godspeed, my friend. And then they go back to look at Ed's face and how,
yeah,
he thinks that's just a perfect way to, it's exactly what he had expected from a fellow test pilot, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if she was super serious, he'd be like, oh shit, I'm never making out of this. But like the fact that she's still willing to joke about it, I think is exactly appropriate, and Ed's face said it all.
Yep. Love it. All right, then we go to Danny preparing the MSAM for launch, and then he asks Ed to let him pilot the mission and explains that he caused the landslide, and Ed freaks out on him, tells him there's going to be a reckoning when this is all over, and no, you can't pilot the MSAM. You spaz. Jesus. This guy is... He really thought he was going to go to Ed and just like take over this mission?
I think he wants to die. That was read on it. The only way he sees out with honor is to die heroically. Uh-huh. And Ed sees that's what I think.
At least make up for it if he doesn't die, right? Like he feels like he can get some sort of closure on this if he is able to successfully take Kelly up there and lives through it, or he can just die. And that either way is okay.
Either way. And it's also, I think, kind of trying to recapture the beginning of this season. Like his thesis is, well, I'm not a complete piece of shit if I am doing X, Y, or Z. But like, I think that's one of the reasons that Ed popped at him is that he's doubling down on the same fucking behavior. That it wasn't just, I think it's a realization that like this wasn't like what Ed would understand as your normal pilot angst shit. You know, that this wasn't just being in a, and I wasn't even sure until Danny said it, that like this wasn't just him being in a drug haze. This was also him just being furious at Ed. And, you know, making poor decisions, but also there's a little bit of malignance in this.
Yeah.
And the fact that he wants to buy his way out of that with a risky mission with Ed's daughter's life and grandson into balance, I think was, well, grandchild. I don't think they ever said that the sex of the child. But I could see why Ed got so pissed.
Oh, yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. It's not the way I expected it to go when the scene started, but by the end of it, I was like, yeah, that works out.
Although I will say that Danny flying this and cratering was our best chance to get the hell out of this. Because like we are still going into next season with the secret between these two men that probably will still be a central part of the show.
8 years after the woman died, he's going to call him up from prison and say, by the way,
I don't know. They're still alive.
The 8 year time jump is what really throws me on a lot of this stuff.
Well, I thought the time jump would put us beyond this shit, but they made sure in the first fucking episode that I knew that this was all going to be the whole damn season.
Maybe Ed's going to have cancer from spending so much time in space and he's going to be on his deathbed. Old man Ed in his 70s or whatever is going to be dying, and then freaking Danny's going to come along and confess.
I'm curious to see what you think about the reckoning, because we got to talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get there.
Okay.
Karen searches for Jimmy, and she calls his phone and sees that his long hair friend has it. This Timothy
douchebag Kenny Rogers
motherfucker douchebag
is what I was calling him.
The gambler. Let's call him the gambler.
The shambler.
The shambler. It's just a pretty quick scene here. It tips her off that something is really, really wrong.
Yeah.
And then we go back over to Margo for her speech to Mission Control before the MSAM launch. And unbeknownst to her team, it is her farewell speech. Margo then goes back to her office and plays her piano.
Yeah, we talked about this. This harkens back to the first episode. You know, Gene Kranz pausing, holding the Apollo 11 countdown. We saw the speech. We saw Margo there as a young, hopeful space woman, space flight controller, and talk about what an honor and privilege it has been to serve them. And what made it is, again, that these two women, Aleda and Margo, are the only ones that grasp the true significance in the room. And it made it like it's such a weirdly intimate scene, even though it takes place in this football sized room with monitors everywhere and theater seating.
And Aleda
taking command. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. And the other element that I love about it is, you know, Margo's caught up in this bad situation and she's accidentally become a Russian agent. But she still has the love for the mission. She still has the love for what she's doing, and it comes through in this scene, and she's able to take the 40 years or whatever she's had at NASA and use that to inspire the next generation, who hopefully will not become Russian agents. But that's the thing that gets me, is like, even in the bad situation, she's doing her best to give life to the mission that she's believed in for so long.
Although this is right out of the Russian playbook. You burn the mentor. You have the mentee burn the mentor so that they're even higher placed and irreprochable. How would
Are you saying this Aleta person is already in the pocket?
Aleta is at a risk of being turned, because that gives them ultimate, like, how the hell could you possibly suspect her? She's the one that turned in the other one. That's how fucking patriotic she was. Mm-hmm. I love that, like, Margo kind of walking off.
Yeah.
Well, he's a git. The Russian Kartish called him a git, and that was enough for him.
Not in the British way, again.
The scene of her walking off the football pitch, so to speak, Aleta is taking command of the room, the voiceover, you hear her giving everybody's order. It was a real passing the torch, even more so than the soft time jump earlier of you know, her being flight director. She'll be running the Molly Cobb Space Center next season, no doubt.
Most likely. Who are they going to promote to mission control? Because we got to have an insight into mission control.
We need an injection of 20 and 30 year olds into this show.
Yes.
Like, there's not a lot.
Danny's coming back to run it.
Yeah. You got Danny and Kelly and Alexi's kid, who's probably going to figure strongly into season 5 and 6, surely. Uh huh. You've got, you got Jimmy, I'm sure is going to be a thing. I don't know what Ellen looks like. President of the United States is usually kind of like the last gig in politics. But we've lost so many. You got Ed. Ed's going to be old. He'll be in his 70s next time we see him.
You think there's a chance next season is the last season? Or did they already greenlight 5?
Well, I don't. I mean, there's always a chance, but I took it to Ronald Moore. I said he had 7 years and he wanted to catch up to the present day.
Oh, right.
So if you want to catch up to present day, you could do that in 2 more seasons. Absolutely.
But you got to establish new characters, because the characters we know and love are not going to last until season 7.
I was kind of surprised that they didn't. I really thought we would see, like, Nick Corrado as a fairly young that, like, but they dusted off a lot of these guys.
And every character they're bringing up from a youngster is now on the rocks. I mean, there's no way Danny continues within NASA. There's no way Jimmy gets into NASA, right? He's never been astronaut material. There's like
Stevens family might go away, other than cameos, to be honest.
Yeah, could be.
They don't have a lot.
Next opportunity to bring someone into mission control that we already know. So we're going to have to do a lot of, like, Aleta's going to have to do a lot of heavy lifting next season, I think.
I think it was more because, like, going in from season 1 to season 2, you had, like, Ed and Gordo and Tracy and Molly and Danielle and Margot. And later we didn't even know. She was just a weird little girl with mental problems in season 1. Like, so you had like a half, I guess if you have a half dozen, and we still have, I think, a half dozen characters, you can introduce enough to care.
Yeah.
You know, Danielle's family, like, she's got a son that might, you know, he's grown up while she's been on Mars.
Son is going to start aging into that range pretty soon. Maybe not next season, but the season after.
You're right. You're right.
Can see him go to space camp or something, you know?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how, because that's I think their big challenge is they've got a Marvel problem, you know, where, like, Captain America and Iron Man
wants out of their contract,
and they've got to rebuild with fucking the Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor and Spider-Man. But yeah, I wonder how they're going to do it, because I felt like they'd do a better job of restocking the shelves than they've had done this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of strange. Anyway, we get a moment of calm before the MSAM launch, which gives Kelly time to tell Ed, I love you. You know, she's all strapping in both to her suit and to the top of the MSAM. And then they're off, man. No wasting no time here. Kelly separates from the MSAM and flies to the Phoenix, and they grab her as Ed falls back toward the planet. I can't even imagine what this would be like.
The waterworks started as soon as she was got in the Peloton suit. Yeah, and yeah. You know, everyone said how proud he would be and everybody misses him. And then you know, Kelly and Ed saying they love each other. And then like Ed getting to be the supremely talented pilot. And the way him and his daughter was just so professional and giving each other the call outs and calling the altitude. And it just felt like this felt like another like Apollo 13 kind of thing. You know, their engineering stuff, their science shit. I thought her visually achieving separation was a beautifully mm-hmm. moving moment, like her actually achieving flight. And then the smile on her face when she realized that she had done it and that she was going to hit her target. And then everyone's reaction, like on the HAB. If you watch, there's just the one Korean guy who has no idea what's going on. He's like, what have I walked into? Because he literally doesn't.
Yeah,
he has no idea that the first gay man on Mars has happened, that there's a pregnancy, that there's like, he's just seeing all these people are being left behind and they're celebrating like maniacs. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I don't think he realizes he's going to be stuck here for a year and a half with them. Like nobody.
Yeah, he did not volunteer for this exactly. Yeah. And then also like, Ed's reaction of like this relief, enormous relief and happiness, and then he is instantly put into the fight of his life.
Yeah,
back like on that. The way he changed his face from that to like, oh shit, now I got to land this thing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great, and it was so. This is also just extremely exciting because again, I thought there's a very good chance one or multiple people may die.
Yeah, I love the shot of Kelly jetting toward the Phoenix as she's aiming for this open hatch, mm-hmm. this open airlock. That's incredible. You know that the scene, like the shot right at separation where Kelly yeah. kind of jumps a little bit off of mm-hmm. the ship. It reminded me a lot of that key art from The Expanse where Julie is yeah. like kind of curled up, like uh-huh. almost like rolling away from a wall. Uh-huh. And I know like they're different scenarios, but I got that visual motif from there.
Yeah.
It's very neat.
There was something rising angel to the imagery of her reaching out and making contact with the Phoenix that I found moving in a way that I can't quite put my finger on.
And I think she was like getting close to blacking out on the ride up. There's a shot where her vision sort of like comes back into focus at some point. Uh-huh. The edges clear up a little bit, which I thought was...
Yeah, they're pulling probably some pretty serious G's on that initial liftoff.
For sure. No, it was great. I love this scene. And then we were back over to Karen, who finds Jimmy in the back of a van, which is also full of explosives. She tries to alert security, but it's too late. It's detonated. Here's how I would save the JSC. I grabbed that fucking phone right off the bomb. That's the first thing I thought when I saw that phone. I'm like, grab that, Karen. That is the trigger. Grab it. And maybe that sets it off, but probably not. I mean,
You did no harm. You did no harm, right?
Right. Either way, it's going off. I say grab the phone.
I say punch douchey Kenny Rogers in the balls as he's trying to dial it. There's no way. No way you can dial 7 digits with that kind of testicular pain.
Yeah,
fair. I think that's how I saved the day. But, we'll have to sim all that out.
Next up, Ed plummets to Mars and he fires the thrusters just before impact. Did it work? We'll have to wait and see.
I got to say that the cuts between Karen screaming, get back, and that fire explosion to Ed's fiery reentry to Mars, the smoking crater on Mars to the smoking crater. I thought this stuff was really fucking excellent.
Yeah, they're really trying to crescendo this. And it works. I think it was great. Just maybe not as great as the truly great episodes that
the duct tape moonwalk is an all timer, but I don't know. Honestly,
the decision not to shoot the Russians, ship. I love it all, and the handshake, it was all great last season. This season I also love it all, just not quite as much.
Okay.
And then we come back down to Earth for the aftermath of the bombing. Karen is dead. Molly leads people, including Elaida, to safety. And then Elaida tries to find Margot in her destroyed office, but her body is nowhere to be found.
It's a damn shame that Karen's last thoughts on Earth were taken up of Jimmy ugly crying in his Canadian tuxedo right in her face. That had to be, you know, she could see her trying to look past him, see the blue skies, but he just wouldn't let it happen.
Yeah. I'm trying to dream here, Jimmy. Trying to dream sweet dreams. You're mucking it all up. As long as we're making jokes, I assumed that the way Molly died was not from smoke inhalation, but she just walked off the edge of one of these newly formed sky cells.
Like, yeah. She's like, you know what? Layout,
but
I'm going to check on the Queen of Darkness. We've had a lot of bad. We got a lot of bad runs. But, you know, she don't deserve to die like this. And she goes in, walks 6 feet and... Yeah.
Maybe she's sitting at her piano. Let me check. Whoops. That first step's a doozy, Molly.
Her memorized location of the now altered JSC floor plan is her undoing. But we talked about this before, but this is just like, it's very visually, it's obviously supposed to remind, you know, if you don't know I can't remember which day, but it happened in April of 95. So like it's very close to being, and I really love how this show is about social pressures and societal pressures and how those things build up, and they might go to different relief valves, but they have to be relieved. They're going to come out. Like these forces in society are going to work their way towards the surface, and they're going to come out this way or that, but they are going to come out.
Yeah.
I'm hearing that the Oklahoma City bombing happened April 19th. We were so close to a meme on that. Holy shit. Can you imagine? What would 420 be if it was forever synonymous with the Oklahoma City bombing?
I mean, probably say blow it up instead of blaze it. I don't know.
Jesus.
Is it too soon? Too soon?
Well, thanks for going a day early, Tim. I appreciate you not destroying this stoner's reason to live here. I thought it was that's one of the best things about the show, that like the more things change, the more things stay the same, that like,
yes,
on the micro things change, but macro there are certain things that just, certain fevers the country has to break, certain,
which really makes me
has to go through,
interested to see how they handle the modern day stuff. That's gonna be interesting.
I'm increasingly wondering if they're just going to flip it where it's going to be crazy liberal progressive Democrats, like, you know, 1970 style weathermen blowing the shit up, and
how you win back a bunch of fans who quit the show when they found out Will was gay.
Yeah.
I don't know. Apparently there's a lot of review bombing going on in these episodes. It's whatever. We don't need to get it all.
Pretty much.
We'll see how it goes. So you mentioned it earlier, but I really want to stress again how good this misdirection is with the Margot thing. It's a magic trick a la, you know, Korean speaking Ed. I assumed that Elaida will just. Well, I mean, Elaida will never know probably what happened to her mentor. And I think that's sad, but also it's this nice misdirection for the audience where we think she got blown up. And then at the very end, we're going to discover, oh, actually, she's living in Russia. It worked out really well.
And I thought the way that the episode gave everyone's reaction time to breathe, like there's several consecutive shots of people processing that their world has changed forever and there's no going back. Mm-hmm. Like Elaida, like getting to Margot's office was one of those things. Ed coming back to Happy Valley and getting the news about Karen, this like, the rug pull where point of no return, and just having them with like the Jeff Russo Max Richter thing that he was doing.
Let's go through that stuff. There is a montage here which kind of sets up it's not really setting up the stage afterwards, but it's dealing with the aftermath of this, the immediate aftermath, where Gregory picks up Ed from the crash site. Danielle tells him that Karen died in the bombing at JSC. And then we see a memorial set up outside of JSC, which Elaida visits. We see Kelly's baby is born and fine. Danny's exiled to the North Korean outpost on Mars. Danielle thinks about her family. Lee gets a message from his wife, and Ellen visits Pam to figure out what they do now. all that stuff is just a big montage, and we could talk about anything individually that you want to. But
okay, did Ed manage to make the Helios blue suits look kind of badass? And him walking away, like walking away from this bad landing.
Yeah, sure. He pulled it off. As much as you can pull that suit off, sure.
I wish he'd pull it off and then wear one of the spare NASA ones and never look back. But I thought that was a really great shot. It's like kind of Lawrence of Arabia moment where the cosmonaut commander is like squinting over the and, you know, he can see the smoke from the thing. But do I see a blue figure? And of course they do. It's Ed fucking Baldwin looking worse. But he's walking. He's walking away from this wreck.
And that's when you knew he's going to be pretty fine.
And the Russian commander like breaking out in this broad smile. I thought that was great. But then again, Daniel, the inversion, and he can't believe it. He's the one that was in all the dangers. Him and Kelly and Karen is the one that managed to get killed at home. Mm-hmm. And him trying to make sense of that. I love that. Kelly cradling her new baby, you know, like she's thinking about her mom. She's thinking about everyone what sacrificed to get her there.
Alita with her family at the memorial, thinking about, you know, all the friends that she undoubtedly lost, people we don't know, but she does.
What do we think of Danny's banishment?
Is this the reckoning that Ed talked about?
I think it doesn't feel
like the reckoning to me, but I guess it has to be. It's the only reckoning that can really come on Mars.
Yeah, I was going to say, being put in isolation, like they're going to get, what's he said, they're going to send supply after. So he'll essentially is being put in solitary confinement. And once a month, they'll give him food and water. That
and
seems
they reinforce
pretty brutal.
That by having him go through the exact same daily routine that the North Korean guy did when he was stranded.
Right.
Out of communication.
Right.
Totally alone and isolated. Yeah.
And it was weird because like, Danny's being the mom, you know, Danielle's being the mom here, and Ed's just kind of hanging back looking glum. And like, I liked his face. There was like all these feelings going through, like, man, are we doing the right thing? But also this kid's fucking the worst. Mm-hmm. And like, I felt like he's cycling through, like, are we doing the right thing versus we have to protect everybody versus I thought that was pretty good. I just don't know. Like, I feel like there's got to be a better way to jail someone than putting them 50 miles, right? 50 miles away?
Yeah, I want to say it was like 90 kilometers, so that would track roughly.
But I guess, what do you do with a guy who's endangered and already killed?
They're keeping him out of a job where he could harm someone else, you know?
It looks like he accepts it. He also is consenting to this treatment, saying that, you know, I kind of deserve this. I don't know.
This can't be good for him long term, though. Like, you look at how this affected the North Korean guy who wasn't a basket case already. And I fully expect Danny to like find this gun and just blow his head off at some time in the interim between now and 2003. And we'll just he'll be a footnote in history. But who knows? Yeah.
I thought what did you think of the montage with Elaida talking about the Mayflower and 1620 and people crossing an ocean to escape their past, to follow their dreams, backlit against all the, you know, Danny looking at his wife and child in the exact same way as his North Korean guy did to his wife, or I guess sweetheart, Danielle seeing her boy who's gotten so big. Like, that's the thing that like took my breath away. It's like, she's missed his entire high school. Like, she left him and like same age as my son, you know,
and she's 14 got another or 15. Year and a half of it. Right.
She's been gone for 2 years, going to be gone another year and a half. Like the sacrifices these people made,
another full 2 years or so.
And that's the thing. It's like they change so much, too. I mean, I guess that's the way that all kids do until they get to. But like, you know, you're just going to miss so much of their life. The Korean guy catching up with his wife. And the fact that, like, you know, eventually, you know, I think they're trying to make a melting pot argument that, you know, whatever you think about the pilgrims coming to America and all the shit that's happened since, this place has turned into is this giant melting pot of people trying to forge something new. And they're making that analogy with the Mars, like all the different nations, nationalities, sexual orientations, political leanings. They're all represented in this incredibly tiny group of people. That is the start of something that's new and permanent.
And it will start in the way that, you know, modern America started, with a bunch of random people coming over and immigrating to this new place and turning it into whatever they brought with them. And whatever they can find in this new place. So
yeah, for good and ill.
Yeah, no, I think it's a nice poetry to end this season on. But it's not quite the end. We have one more scene here where Sergei is living in America and Margot is living in Russia in 2003. And we get Radiohead's Everything in Its Right Place playing over the top, which brings us into a new era of music and a new era altogether.
Yeah, Margot wakes up in her Russian apartment and she opens up the blinds and it's Moscow and it's very cold and it's very gray.
Yeah.
Like, that's what that window scene was looking, you know, good and then Lord, you see that looked
Sergei living like a, what you think of a quintessential American life, right? Going out in your slippers and your robe. Yeah, to pick up the newspaper, your waving high to your neighbors. It's the Truman Show, the beginning of the Truman Show every day.
Yep.
It's that stereotype of American life.
Right.
That is so far out of date in 2003, it's laughable, right? Like, this is a 1950s kind of image of America that you stereotype, but here he is living the American dream. And I don't know if he's feeling that. I assume he's feeling that.
I wonder if he knows yet, like, because like my at this point, like when Sergei picks up the paper, this is still the next day. I don't think we go to 2003 until Margot's feet hit the floor. So like, I think at this point, he might just be like shocked. Like, he's reading his eulogy, this front page news about the Johnson Space Center. There's you want to pause. Right. There's a lovely eulogy to this is how I found out Molly died. There's a lovely eulogy where it goes into all of her heroics saving, you know, Wallaby or whatever his name is, and her distinguishing herself in the NASA's first women in space movement. And, you know, talks about how she kept on going in and going in and they found her buried under rubble. But yeah. Oh, we also kind of yada yadded over Ellen and Pam.
Oh, right. Right.
Are these people relevant politically?
She's still the president currently, but she won't be in 8 years, so I don't know. This could be the ending for Ellen's story as well. Like, she just walks into Pam's house, you know, for a new start.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll see. Larry would be interesting. Totally absent from this episode. I thought that was interesting. You never even hear a word from him. You never even see him.
Yeah. Well, he was always kind of like, you know, the side dish, right? Into the Ellen main course.
Yeah, I mean, if you're running from the wolf and run into the bear, I mean, he's not even the wolf, right? Like, his problem was you were chasing a rabbit and you ran into the wolf.
I wonder if they're trying to set up something like, do you remember when John Glenn went back to space? Like, he was this old ass astronaut. He has been a senator for many, many years. And back in, I think, the early 2000s, for some kind of publicity stunt, when he was just shy of 80, they sent him back into space for one more mission. I could see Ellen doing something like that in a season or two.
I thought that's what they were doing with old man Ed.
Ed's not quite 80.
No.
But no, yeah. Do you think we'll ever see Ed in space again?
I doubt it. I really doubt it.
Me too. Gosh, what else we talk about?
I think that's it. It's been a long episode.
We're going to have one more wrap-up podcast, and it'll be probably as long and short as however people want to talk about it. We might have a couple things to say. The one thing I guess we didn't talk about is, how do you feel about the North Korean? We talked about how that was so improbable. At the end, like, Do you think that between just kind of processing it a week and seeing this episode that you feel a little bit better? Because people were pretty salty about it on the subreddit, I noticed, especially. Do you think
Yeah. I mean, I think they pulled it off. I think like the scale of that was appropriate, right? Like we can stick two people into this capsule. We can boost them towards Mars and we can effectively just let them crash land with parachutes that barely open. And it's a Hail Mary, you know, it is.
That's the thing.
It is crazy. Of course it's crazy.
It is crazy. It's a 1 in 1,000 shot. Like it's the opposite of NASA where they're, you know, they certainly take calculated risks, but they expect everyone, you know, they have a plan for getting back.
Yeah,
I think so too.
Redundancies that the NASA has just don't exist on this North Korean ship, and that's fine. Yeah, I mellowed on it for sure.
We want to hear from you people. FAM at baldmove.com. What did you think of this season? What do you think the prospects are for season 4? You got any predictions for how things are going to happen? Do you have any complaints or kudos for how things went down this season? FAM, of course, stands for All Mankind. FAM at baldmove.com is how you want to get that and into us. And we will be back next week to talk about it, to put For All Mankind in a successful holding orbit until we can transfer to a burn in the next season. If I continue my tortured space metaphor, it's been a real journey. Doing For All Mankind for season 3. I appreciate having everybody along with us. If this is your first ride with us, know that we've got a whole bunch of other stuff going on too. We're just putting Westworld to bed, but the Super Bowl of our year is about to start. Oh boy, Amazon and HBO are going head to head with fantasy shit. It's going to be Rings of Power versus House of the Dragon. Two fantasy series enter. Will one leave? Will they both leave? Will they both be carried out in stretchers? Will they both emerge victorious as friends? Who knows? We're going to be there in Bald Move. We also have a bunch of prestige movies we're going to be talking about, a bunch of first run movies, lots of stuff coming up at baldmove.com. And if you like the prestige stuff, maybe you can check out Bald Move Prestige. If you like the pulpier superhero and dragon stuff, check out Bald Move Pulp. We'd love to have you for more shows. And then, yeah, we'll see you next week for the season wrap up and maybe on a show soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.